Well, church, if I was to say to you the name Lori Loughlin, what do you think about? Some of you think about the 80s and 90s star of the hit TV show Full House, and others of you think outrageous college admissions scandal, one of the largest in the history of our country. It seems as if her reputation has been irreversibly damaged. If I were to say to you the name Lance Armstrong, do you think greatest cyclist in the history of the United States, seven-time Tour de France winner? Do you think the yellow bracelets? Do you think all the good? Or do you think cheater, doping, lying, deceiver, stripped of all seven titles? If I said to you Michael Vick, do you remember prolific NFL quarterback who is beyond athletic? Or do you think about a dog fighting scandal in his life? If I say Bill Cosby, do you think beloved comedian, the lovable Cliff Huxtable from the Cosbys? Or do you think sexual predator? I don't mention those names to further tarnish their reputations, but a quick Google search of fallen heroes will bring up endless lists of people just like these that have the same fate. There's just something devastating when we place people on pedestals, and yet they act in a way that is unbecoming to their title, unbecoming to the pedestal on which we've placed them, to that position that we've given them. And we have this false notion that because of this position that they've been given, that our heroes of our lives are without flaws. And that's just not the case. Somehow we think the flaws are unique to me, but not to them. And that's just not the case. But as we look across the landscape of politics, and you look across the landscape of musicians and actors and sports or whatever, the unfortunate concept transcends all of those environments, men and women alike, rich and poor alike. It simply does not matter. And they even show up in the Bible. Our biblical heroes of faith, unfortunately, are men and women just like you and me. That they're flawed, that they're in process, that they're broken, just like us. Last week we met Abram. We met him for the very first time. We saw a man who was called out of his ancestral homeland. He was called out of Ur of the Chaldeans. He was called by a God he did not know, by a God he did not worship, by a God he had never heard from before. He was called out of a polytheistic family. He was called when he was 75 years old, who had a 65-year-old wife who was barren and said, "You are going to be a great nation." And I bet they laughed. And they were called, and he says, "And I'm going to call you out of that land, and I'm going to call you to a land, but I'm not going to tell you exactly where. Just start walking, and I'll tell you as you go. To a land that I will show you." And so he went, but he went halfway. He went halfway to a place that felt comfortable, that felt safe. At least he moved, and he stayed there until his father's death. He made it the rest of the way then. And he began, as he walked along that 1,500-mile journey, he gets all the way to Canaan. By the time he gets there, his faith has grown. And when he walks into Canaan, he begins to plant a flag. And he begins to look at them. And he begins to put God on display for everyone in that place. And he went place to place, and he built altars to this God. And I have to give credit where credit is due, because he did an amazing feat by responding to that call of God on his life. However, as we watch his life progress, not every day in Abram's life is like that. In fact, we're about to see this fragile faith in God falter. If you have your Bibles with you this morning, I hope you do. We're in Genesis chapter 12. If you're new with us, you're going to want your Bible every week, because that's what we do here. We walk through our Bible together. We're in Genesis chapter 12. And what you're going to see there is Abram, he's now entered the promised land. He's built altars. He has called upon the name of the Lord. He is representing to the Canaanites around him that he is a follower of a God, but of a very, very different God. And this has made him different in that he didn't come to blend in. He didn't come to coexist. He came to plant a flag to God. He came to proclaim the name of the Lord. But as we quickly transition into this new stage in Abram's life, we find out in verse 10 that something intense is happening in the world around him. Look at verse 10. It says, "Now there was a famine in the land, and Abram went down to Egypt to live there for a while because the famine was severe." And apparently this famine was so severe, it was so catastrophic, and really we don't know what brought about this famine. It could have been insects, it could have been disease, it could have been drought, we don't know. But he is forced to make a decision for his wife, Sarai, a decision for his nephew, Lot, a decision for all of those who are following him now, that are with him. And he makes a decision to go to Egypt, the breadbasket of the world, where there's food aplenty, where he knows that he can provide for his family. But here's the question that so many times we fail to ask when we get here is, where is the Abram from last week? Because here's the problem. Some of you are reading this section and you're like, of course he went to Egypt. I would go to Egypt too. And I would go, are you sure? Because the question we have is, where is the guy from last week? Where is the man that built those altars? Where is the man that turned to God and said, Lord, what do you want me to do? Where is the guy that asked God first instead of go someplace and ask God to bless him? I don't know if you do that. I don't. But maybe you do, where you make decisions, you go someplace and say, oh, God, please bless me in the decisions I've made. Where's the guy that says, Lord, where do you want me to go? Is it your desire for me to leave the promised land, the land that you've called me to? Are you asking me to leave this land where I've built altars for you, where I've walked 1,500 miles to get to, or do you want me to go to Egypt? Is that your plan for me to go, or is your plan for me to stay? That dialogue with God, it simply never occurs. There is no prayer, there is no worship, there is no turning to God anywhere in the rest of chapter 12. But I get what he must be feeling in this moment. I think you do too. Like, hey, I'm hungry. You know, I've got a wife who's hungry. I've got a nephew. He's hungry. We have no food to eat. All these people that followed me from Haran, they're starving. They put their trust in me. They've left their homes, and they're all looking to me. All these people are looking to me. All these animals are looking to me to provide. So I need to pull myself up by my own proverbial bootstraps, and I just need to kick it into gear, and I need to figure out a solution to this problem. Can you feel the pressure he's under? All eyes are looking at him. Can you feel the tension here? Abram, what are you going to do? And heading off to a place to find food sounds noble. Right? That sounds smart and it sounds good, but we're about to see that this decision, that these thoughts he's having are actually quite reckless. And what we're going to see is difficulties in our lives usually expose our default response to crisis. Difficulties in your life will bring to the surface your default responses to crisis. You see, when Abram walked into the land last week, all was good. God had taken care of him. God had called him. God had provided for him on this journey. He knew with assurance that God was there and that God was with him. But in this moment, things got hard. Things got difficult. And he reverts back to the ways that got him through difficult times in the past. And what's interesting is God never claims to have caused the famine. There's no evidence that God said, I'm gonna make this famine happen. We don't know how it arrived, but God is going to use it as a marked moment. God is going to use it as a refining moment, as a fork in the road in Abram's life to see how he is going to respond. And church, this is so typical of how God works in our lives too. Oftentimes, when difficulties come into your life, you are standing at a crossroads, and God is saying, I wonder if they'll trust me. Do they really believe in me? Am I really their provider? Is their faith really what they declare it to be all around them, or is there something else going on? Forks in the road have this way of revealing the depth of our faith. I want you to listen to the words of Deuteronomy 8. A little different here, but similar. It says, "Remember how the Lord your God led you all the way in the wilderness these 40 years to humble and test you in order to know what was in your heart, whether or not you would keep his commands. He humbled you, causing you to hunger, and then feeding you with manna, which neither you nor your ancestors had known, to teach you that man does not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of the Lord." It's a guy by the name of Jesus that said that exact same thing. Cheater, right? Said the exact same thing. God is allowing this difficult moment in Abram's life to ask him, "Do you trust me when it really matters? Do you trust me when it really matters?" When the rubber meets the road type of moments in life appear, not just in theory, not just in what ifs, but actually appear and it presses on you. Do you trust that I can provide for you when things get hard, or will you revert to your old ways? Can you relate to that? I mean, I can. Because when things start pressing on me, like, I better figure this out. I've got to figure this out for my family. I've got to figure this out for our church. All eyes are looking at me. But do I trust him really? This moment reveals one of Abram's fatal flaws. The idea that self-sufficiency and self-preservation is actually possible. Some of you right now are like, "What? It's not?" Yeah. Rethink your faith for a second. Self-sufficiency is not possible for anyone except God himself. Self-preservation, you might think you're in control. Your family might even let you think you're in control, but you are so not. It's almost like God is saying, in all of your altar building, in all of your praying, Abram, let me reveal the true depth of your faith. This difficulty will show you just how little you trust me to provide for your needs and for the needs of your family. When all you can find is abundant hunger, where will you turn? Will you turn to you, or will you turn to me? And unfortunately, the story here goes from bad to worse. Look at verse 11. It says, "As he was about to enter Egypt, he said to his wife Sarai, 'I know what a beautiful woman you are.'" Hey, that sounds great, right? Your wife's 65, and you're looking and say, "You are a hot mama." So far, you're getting credit. But wait, then he says, "When the Egyptians see you, they will say, 'This is his wife.' Then they will kill me, but will let you live." Is that a compliment, or is he just trying to save his rear end? The compliment just got lessened a little bit. Verse 13, "Say you are my sister, so that I will be treated well for your sake and my life will be spared because of you. Hey, honey, here's what I need you to do. We're going to roll in this land. I know you're 65, but you're really, really beautiful. I know it, and everyone else knows it. I mean, you're drop-dead gorgeous, and the Egyptians are going to see that." And he's not wrong, because in just a second, you're going to see the Egyptians go, "Yeah, she's hot." You're going to see that in just a second. And so, honey, here's how we're going to play this. You're not my wife. You're my sister. Now, to be fair, that's a half-truth, because Sarai is, in fact, Abram's half-sister, so they were born of the same father but different mothers, and a practice that was allowed back then, but then was later forbidden in the Mosaic Law. But what we're seeing in Abram in this moment is a deep-seated issue. You get the impression that this is not the first time that Abram has told a lie to get out of difficult situations in his 75 years here on this earth. This certainly isn't the first time that Abram has used this tactic to get out of a jam. Hey, ain't it worked before? And he's reverting, in a sense, back to his old habits. And old habits, by the way, are old habits for a reason. They are so hard to get rid of. So many of us go, oh, old habits are hard to break. The problem is if you break them, they're still there. They're just waiting to creep in. To get rid of them is really, really difficult. And for Abram, the root of self-sufficiency and self-preservation has deep roots in his life. Think about it. He's basically saying, I want to make sure that my life is okay, even if it means putting my bride, my wife, in a very difficult and very awkward situation. And so that's what he does. And in some ways, we can empathize with him, can't we? Because he's like, hey, we're starving. And my name's Abram. I am a powerless foreigner coming into a land filled with powerful and wealthy people. I have no numbers on my side. I just can't go in there and just take things. And these Egyptians are going to see his wife, and they're just going to take her. I'm coming here looking for food. I'm coming here looking for help. And they're just going to take my wife. But I can protect her. Because if I just pretend that she's my sister, then I'm responsible for negotiating the marriage deal. And then when any suitors roll up and try to ask for her hand in marriage, try to figure out how to marry her, I can just say, no, thank you, we're not interested. No, thank you, we're not interested. No, thank you, I'm not interested. I can do that over and over again. And you might think that's a great plan. And you would be wrong, right? Some of you go, that makes total sense. But you know what? The plan backfires. Look at verse 14. It says, when Abram came to Egypt, the Egyptians saw that Sarai was a very beautiful woman. And when Pharaoh's officials saw her, they praised her to Pharaoh, and she was taken into the palace. And you're like, oops. Uh-oh. Things are not going as planned. Because they didn't ask for her. They just took her. He didn't get a chance to fend off suitors. That's not what happened. They just took her into the palace. The plan just blows up in his face, and his worst fears are realized because his wife is now taken into Pharaoh's harem. And this is really, really awkward for her, wouldn't you think? I mean, so I don't want to minimize this, but it is awkward for Abram as well. Because he just put his wife in this situation. She's like, I'm sorry, what's happening right now? Where am I going? And he's like, honey, you know, and you know what she's saying. If I get out of here, I'm gonna kill you. You know that's what if I make it out of here, you're a dead man walking, is probably what she's saying. And so he certainly jeopardizes his relationship with her, but he also jeopardizes this promise, this Abrahamic covenant that's made, because you and Sarai are supposed to be the parents to a great nation, not Sarai and Pharaoh. You're supposed to be it. And so this is an odd situation on so many accounts for all involved, and it gets even stranger. Look at verse 16. It says, he treated Abram well for her sake, and Abram acquired sheep and cattle, male and female donkeys, male and female servants, and camels. Hey, Abram, your sister's awesome. Here's some camels, here's some oxen, here's some servants, sort of like a dowry for what you've allowed me to have. And can you imagine what Abram must have been feeling in this moment? Can you imagine the guilt that he's feeling? The anxiety he's feeling, the panic? I mean, it's gotta be just sheer panic happening right here. Like, what do you do in this moment? Because this great plan, apparently he didn't ask his wife. I don't think he asked her, because it backfires, and she probably would have said, told ya, that's a terrible plan. But instead of preserving life, he lost it. Instead of maintaining control of the situation, it quickly spirals out of control. Instead of protecting his wife, which was his responsibility, which was his privilege, which was his duty, his choice has put her in harm's way, and now he's powerless to fix it. What's he really going to do? And my thought is, have you ever been there? Have you ever been there? Have you ever been in a moment like that, where you made a decision? It's a little risky. You know, maybe there's a hint of truth in your lie, and you put it out there, and you thought, you know what? We're just gonna do this, it'll be fine. I don't need to really ask my wife. I don't need to tell my spouse. It'll be fine. I don't need to tell my employer, it'll be fine. I'll just fly under the radar, and then all of a sudden, that lie comes to fruition. It got found out in the situation that you had planned for, that you knew was a sure thing. Now it just isn't. And you don't know what to do. Your well thought out plan is simply unraveling, and there's nothing but you can do about it but pray. Now, fortunately, in this moment, part of the custom of that day is that you have to make sure that any woman that's brought into your harem is not pregnant when she gets there. And so there is this sort of waiting period that has to happen. And so Pharaoh doesn't sleep with her. So any chance that Pharaoh would have slept with Sarah immediately is probably not going to happen. So this potential disaster, at least in this moment, is averted. But what's concerning, or for me even more disturbing, is that the one thing that Abram can do in this moment to fix this situation is to be honest, and he won't do it. As parents, we call it doubling down. Hey, son, did you sneak out of the window? No. Then why are the police delivering you to the door? Right? You know, that's, you double down. Like, or the people who say, no, I didn't do that. And you're like, you know, I have a Ring camera, right? You know, we have cameras in the house, right? I've got you on video. No. Faked, deep fake. No, doubling down. So all he had to do was be honest, but he won't do it. All he has to do is go to Pharaoh and say, listen, Pharaoh, listen, I'm Abram. My God called me out of my homeland, my ancestral homeland of Ur of the Chaldeans. We walked 1,500 miles to Canaan. We got there, and we had no food. And so I didn't know what to do, so I came here to you. And I'm not a powerful man. You're a powerful man. I'm not a wealthy man. You're a wealthy man. And you know what? My wife is beautiful. You've seen that. But she's my wife, she's not my sister, and I've done you wrong. I need to confess that to you. I need to be honest with you about what I've done here. But Abram is unwilling to do that. He's unwilling to admit that he was just scared for his life. In fact, he doesn't confess. He actually gets caught, and God's got to step in to protect this patriarch hero of the faith. Look at verse 17. It says, but the Lord inflicted serious diseases on Pharaoh and his household because of Abram's wife, Sarai. Abram's sin splashed on other people. His sin affected others. And the assumption is in the ancient world was that if a disease or something came on your life, in the ancient world, everything was spiritual. In our world, we discount the spiritual so much. But in that day, everything is spiritual. So what they would have done is they would have seen this as not just a physical thing, they would have seen it as a spiritual thing. So they would look and say, why are the gods punishing me? Why are my gods punishing me? So he would have gone out and he would have offered sacrifices to try to appease all of these gods that he worships. But nothing he did worked. And somehow through the process, Pharaoh begins to connect the dots. And what becomes abundantly clear is that the condition of his household, the condition he is suffering right now, his wife, his kids, his family, all those around him, is because of Abram and a lie that's been told. He is suffering because of the Christian. He's suffering because of the God follower. Look at verse 18. It says, so Pharaoh summoned Abram. What have you done to me? He said. Why didn't you tell me she was your wife? Why didn't you say she's my sister? Why did you say that? Why did you say she's my sister so that I took her to be my wife? Now then, here's your wife. Take her and go. Then Pharaoh gave orders about Abram to his men, and they sent him on his way with his wife and everything he had. And I thought, what a sad day when the non-Christian, when the person who has no faith in God, who's not bowed their knee before the Lord, when this person who does not walk with God or fear God holds the God follower to the standard of morality. Abram, what are you doing to me? Why are you treating me this way? Why did you lie to me? You came here looking for help, and I gave you food. You came here looking for me to provide for you, and I did just that. I've done all these things, and now you're going to lie to me? And Pharaoh could have made his life miserable, couldn't he? He could have killed him. Said, fine, I'll just take your wife. I'll kill you and keep your wife. He could have done that. He could have thrown him in prison. He could have tortured him. He could have done all this sort of stuff. He had the power to do all of those things, but he doesn't. He just says, take your stuff, take your wife, and get out of here. I'm going to give you a police escort to the border. And so go home. And God uses this season of waywardness to teach Abram a lesson. But you know what's interesting once again is God still doesn't run Abram into the ground. Because that's what we think, right? We think we should just go, oh, you're such a loser. Or he doesn't treat him like the dog that peed on the carpet where you take his nose and rub it in and say, see what you did? Look at this mess you made. He doesn't do any of that. That's not how God responds at all to Abram in this moment. In fact, Abram leaves, and when he leaves, according to verse 2, he leaves with all sorts of wealth. He actually grows with more sheep. He gets more camels. He gets more servants. He gets more of everything. And God is going to allow the school of natural consequences to be Abram's teacher. And while Abram is learning a very, very hard lesson, God is not done with Abram. And God is not done with you. Some of you in this room have made really poor choices in your marriage. You've made very poor choices with your kids, your spiritual life, at work, with your finances. You've made terrible choices and you feel like a failure, but God is not done with you yet. He's not. Failure has this way of being one of life's greatest teachers, doesn't it? Now, there's a couple things I think to remember. When you feel like a failure, there's a couple things I think you need to remember. First thing you need to remember, everyone faces famines. You're not alone in the famines that you're facing, in the difficulties that have rolled into your life. You might feel alone. That's the lie of the evil one. There's no one else that's going through it like you. Everyone else's marriage, everyone else's kids, everyone else's finances, everyone else's job, whatever, everyone else's health is perfect except you. And you know that's not true, but it feels like it is. Church, none of us are immune to famines in our lives. And though our famines may look very different than the period of hunger that Abram faced, we nonetheless go through difficulties just the same. And each famine has this interesting way of bringing us to the same type of situation. Our famines bring us to forks in the road. And you've got to decide, on whom will I lean? In this famine, whom will I trust? I have to decide, will I trust God to provide for me and my family in this difficulty, or am I going to handle this one on my own? Am I going to do the things that I've always done to get me through these situations, or will I trust the one in whom I serve? Because it's one thing to build altars and proclaim his name when your belly is full, but it is quite another to trust God in the moments of difficulty and you're in famine. Second thing I think that's true here is every escape contains a lie. Satan is a tricky dude. You see, there's a belief out there that we can do life without God. And Abram, in this moment, he believed, God, I don't need you for this one. God, actually now, I used to trust you with everything, but now, you know what? You just take care of the big things, and I'll take care of the day-to-day stuff. I mean, we never do that, but he apparently did that. God, you take care of the big stuff. I'll take care of the data stuff. So you know what? Everyone's hungry. I'm going to go to Egypt. I'll be right back. I'm just going to go where there's food. I'm going to do what's right and noble and take care of my family. And I know you called me here, but I need to go there. So it doesn't make any sense. And so we'll just kind of figure it out, God, as we travel together. Abram fell for the lie. Adam and Eve fell for the same lie. You and I fall for, it's the same lie. Apparently, it's a really good lie. And it's a lie that we know, but we don't know somehow. It's a lie that that we can navigate this world without the help and guidance of a sovereign, loving Father. You take care of the small stuff. He'll take care of the big stuff. Spit, handshake, and we're good. It's the lie from the beginning. It's the temptation that you and I are still offered today. Third thing is, I would say every Abram struggles with a weakness. Every Abram struggles with a weakness. You can think you don't struggle, and Satan's just laughing at you. Everybody in here has a weakness. If you find yourself resonating with Abraham, with Abram this morning, going, yeah, I've been there. I haven't sold my wife, you know, to Pharaoh. I hope, you know, right? I hope you haven't done that. But you know, we've all done stupid. Some of us are like have master's degree in that. And so we've made the decisions that look good, but then we're like, man, that was foolish. What was I thinking? 1 John 1:8 says, if we claim to be without sin, we deceive ourselves and the truth is not in us. Don't think you're sin-free. Don't think you don't have a weakness, and don't think Satan doesn't know what it is. He knows what it is. These flaws can lead us to make very poor choices with often painful consequences, not just on me, not just on my spouse, not just on my kids, but on people who have done maybe nothing wrong. And if we don't drag them into the light, if we don't admit what we struggle with, you're going to live your life in Egypt. You will live your life in Egypt. Fourth thing I think is true in this statement here is every compromise jeopardizes a Sarah. Every compromise you make jeopardizes a Sarah. Ladies, can you imagine being in her position? Like, other than I'm going to kill him, you know, when I get out. I mean, can you imagine the fear she's going through? I mean, can you imagine the disappointment with the guy who's supposed to be leading the family? The guy that's supposed to protect her and the family, lead her and the family, provide for them, care for her and the family, and really do his best to avoid nasty situations just like this. He jeopardizes her trust in him to lead and to keep her safe. And the reason they came to Egypt was to save the family, and they're doing just the opposite. He's done just the opposite. Can you imagine the pain that she must have been feeling in this moment, deceived by her husband, not caring for her, putting his needs above her own, and saying, I will never have a child. And if I have a child, it's going to be by Pharaoh. This has all gone wrong. All these promises that I've hoped for and I've longed for have all gone wrong because of him. Don't ever think your compromise only affects you. My sin only affects me. There is no sin that only affects you. There is no sin. That's a lie from the pit of hell. If you think your sin only affects you, Satan's winning. There's always a Sarah involved. Finally, every Egypt has a Pharaoh. Every Egypt you're in has a Pharaoh. There are people that are watching us. There are men and women in your life who have not bowed their knee to the Lord above, who are watching you in your Egypt going, will they live differently than me? Or are we exactly the same except for where they spend their Sunday mornings and their Wednesday nights? That's what they're doing. They're looking at you, they're watching your life, and they're watching what you say and what you do, and they're going, that is not consistent what's coming out of their mouth. And we may not be famous like Abram. We may not be people on Instagram that have the blue check, you know, next to them that's like uber famous. But there are people watching your life wondering if God really makes a difference in your life, or do you just say that he does? Does he show up in your life day to day? Do you trust him with every situation, good or difficult? How do you respond when life gets tough? They're watching. Do you act like everyone else around you? Or do you handle yourselves differently because of the God that you say you serve? And we see these things in Abram's life, and we can relate, because there's people watching me, and there are people watching you. And you're the only picture that some of them see of who Jesus is. What are they seeing? Every Egypt has a Pharaoh. So when we find ourselves in situations like this, the question becomes, how do we respond? Because I think we can identify with this and say, yes, I've done that. I've lived into stupid. I've made decisions that have jeopardized my family because I want to be in control, because I want to preserve my life. How do we get out of these situations? Because if we don't get it right, we're going to end up being stuck in these Egypts, and we're going to live a life that we were never designed to live, that we don't want to live. And as devastating as this is, you want to know what the beauty of chapter 12 is? There's a chapter 13. Some of you in the middle of chapter 12, there is a chapter 13 coming, and it can be a beautiful thing. The best thing about chapter 12 is chapter 13, because the story doesn't end here. And I want you to watch what Abram does next, because I think there's some valuable lessons once we've come to grips with who we are, of what we're capable of the sin nature inside of us, and how do we move forward in these situations? How do we navigate through them? Because you see, Proverbs 24:16 says, For though the righteous fall seven times, they rise again, but the wicked stumble when calamity strikes. And according to the proverb, the difference between the two groups isn't that one sins and the other one does not sin. That's not what the proverb says. It's what they do in their sin, their response to sin when they're aware of it. Here are a few things that I think might help. Here are things that we see in Abram's life that I think are gold. First, Abram turns from his Egypt. Some of you are like, duh, and then I want to look back at you and then go, why don't you? So don't duh me without me duhing you. Okay? Because if that's how it starts, the first thing it starts with, you've got to turn from your Egypt. Look at verse 1 of chapter 13. It says, so Abram went up from Egypt to the Negev with his wife and everything he had, and Lot went with him. So he literally turns his back on Egypt. So the New Testament idea here is that he changed direction. He stopped going that way. He did 180 and walked the exact opposite way. So he changed one's mind about it. It means to rethink and go in the opposite direction. Abram is saying, I'm not going to go in that direction any longer. That is not healthy and that's not good. And yeah, sure, he got an escort to the border. He got some help from Pharaoh, but he's turning his back on that season of life. Some of you need to turn your back on the decisions you've made and go back and go a different way. You've got to go, there's a better way, there's a different way. There's his way, and this was my way. I confess that this is my way, and I'm going to go and leave this land and walk out of here. But look at what he does next. Abram comes back to the promised land. Look at verse 3. I'll get to 2 in a second. From the Negev, he went from place to place until he came to Bethel, to the place between Bethel and Ai, where his tent had been earlier and where he had first built an altar. There, Abram called on the name of the Lord. Egypt's not his home. It's not his home. Because a home isn't a place. Home is an identity. Home isn't a place. I grew up, I was born in St. Petersburg. This is not my home. Home isn't here. I have a new identity, I have a different, I went to Minnesota for 10 years. Some of you might say that's hell, but it wasn't. It was great because I was with people there who loved Jesus, and I felt like I was at home there because my identity isn't in a place, it's in the person and work of Jesus Christ. He doesn't belong in Egypt. He belongs home with God. And that same identity is not just true in Abram, who was called by his God, but is true of us as believers in Jesus Christ. Ephesians chapter 1, verse 4 says, for he chose us in him before the creation of the world to be holy and blameless in his sight. In love, he predestined us for adoption to sonship through Jesus Christ in accordance with his pleasure and will. You are a son or daughter of the Most High God. That's like, yes, right? You have a new sonship, a new daughter. The king says, you are mine, and there's nothing you can do about it now. There's nothing you can do to make the king love you more, and there's nothing you can do to make the king love you less. Some of you are trying, but you can't. because God has grafted you into his family. And there's nothing you can do to change that. You're not defined by your sin. You're defined by God and how God sees you, which is perfect. Why does he see you as perfect? Because of the shed blood and the resurrection of his son, Jesus Christ, which we're going to hoot and holler about next week. Yes. That, no one's ever looked at you and said, you know what? You're perfect. Said no spouse ever. Right? Said no kid ever. But when he sees you, he goes, I see you as perfect because of the shed blood of my son, Jesus Christ, and his resurrection. But did you notice what else Abram did here? So he turns back on Egypt, but it says Abram returned to the altar. He went back to where his tent had been at the beginning between Bethel and Ai, to the place of the altar which he had made earlier. And the thought is, why? Like, why does he go back to the altar? Why does he go back there? Because that's the last place he had fellowship with God. God didn't move. He had. So oftentimes you're like, God, where are you? He's like, same place I was when you left me. Same place I was where you left me. He's like, but why? This is the place where he and God had fellowship. He's going to go back to a place to remember God's character. He's going back to remember God's goodness, to remember God's provision, and really to live into and lean into this promise of God. And we don't know, but I wonder if when he got there, he thought, what was I thinking? Like, I wonder when he got back there, he was like, what is it? What is it that's so broken in me as a man? What is it that's so broken in me as a husband, that's so broken in me as the leader of a family that I put my wife and the whole future in jeopardy because I want to save my own life? What's going on with me, Lord, that would cause me to abandon all that I know is true, to abandon your goodness and to abandon your protection? Why is it that I need to take the reins of my life back from you and just go my own way and make all the decisions on my own without asking you a thing? I wonder if his time at the altar was filled with great confession, great repentance, seeking forgiveness. I think it's a great example for us today. When you leave your Egypt and you return back to a place going, what was I thinking? That's a great time for you to say, oh God, I blew it. Oh God, forgive me. Oh God, I confess that I took the reins of my own life and I was making decisions on my own and I fell on my face, God. Final thing is, Abram calls in the name of the Lord. That literally means he cried out to the Lord for help. That's what that means. He made an appeal to God for help. And I thought, help with what? Because he's out of Egypt. He's back in Canaan. And if you look at verse 2, he left with all the stuff. Like, how is that? I'd like that to happen to me occasionally. It seems like when I get caught, like everything breaks down. I lose everything. This guy gets everything. So help with what? Like, he's got the stuff. He's got the girl. He's got the family. I mean, he's got wealth. I think he's going, God, I started out white hot. I heard you. I trusted you. I left the land of my ancestors, Ur of the Chaldeans. I listened to you and I walked 1,500 miles following you. And once I got to this new land called Canaan, which is where you led me, I lived for you and I built an altar to you. And I put a flag in the ground and I told anyone that would listen about you. But somewhere along the way, you turned to we, turned to me. How did that happen, God? Somewhere along the line, I took over. And I think his prayer is, God, may that never be again. Ever pray that prayer? God, may that never be again. If not, maybe that should be your prayer this morning. God, I've messed up big time and lost my way in regards to who's really in control of my life. May my eyes be fixed on you. When the sun is shining or when the rain is falling, help me to seek you when my kids are great or when my kids are rotten, when my marriage is all that I'd hoped for or when my marriage is not what I'd hoped for, when my church is all that I want it to be and when my church is the furthest thing from what I want it to be, when the diagnosis comes in and it's clear or when it comes and it's troubling, when my job is awesome or my job is terrible, may my eyes stay fixed on you. May you be the one to whom I turn with every high and every low. Church, you can return from your Egypt. You can return from your Egypt and call on the name of the Lord once again. He is there, and while your circumstances may have changed, your identity has not. He is still there waiting for you every day because our God has not moved, you have. Amen. Abram is such a great model on how to respond in these moments of what it looks like to live out godly confession, godly repentance, to turn around and walk the other way and then to go back and praise the name of our God. Church, this is the gospel according to Genesis.